Hello from Kuala Lumpur. I'm Gary Bowerman, and on today's pod, I'll be talking all things travel in Southeast Asia with Stuart McDonald, founder of Travelfish.org. So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show. Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. This is the second in our two-part special on the future of independent travel publishing in Southeast Asia. Today, it's my great pleasure to speak with Stuart McDonald, founder and publisher of Travelfish, one of the leading online portals for independent travelers in our region. I hope you enjoy the interview that we recorded yesterday. So, Stuart McDonald, founder of Travelfish.org, welcome to the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Thanks for having me.
How are you doing over there in Bali?
We're good. It's very quiet. But otherwise, it's not too bad.
Yeah, okay. So there's a lot of things I want to talk about regarding Travelfish, the business of content and travel. But firstly, I want to talk about you and your travel history. So you've been traveling all your life, but where and when did travel actually take hold? And how did you make your way from Australia to Southeast Asia?
I lived in Asia when I was a kid, in Japan and South Korea, and then in Europe a little bit later on after that, traveling with my father's work. And when I was in my early 20s, sort of in that university break thing, I did what turned out to be a two-year round-the-world trip. Mm-hmm. And sort of States, Europe, South Asia, and then Southeast Asia. And when I booked a ticket, I had to pick somewhere to stop in Southeast Asia. And it really had, I had little interest in it. And I just picked Bangkok because that was convenient, you know.
That was when?
This is in 92, 93.
Okay.
And so then when I... 18 months later or so, when I arrived in Bangkok, I'm like, oh my God, you know, this place is amazing. Everybody's got a motorbike and it was just crazy. And I've been coming back to the region ever since. So then my wife and I moved up here. And then I ended up doing guidebooks for a while, like self-publishing them. And then my wife and I moved up here in 97. Mm-hmm. And we're in Bangkok for 7 years and Phnom Penh for two, Jakarta for two. And we've been in Bali now, I don't know, 11 years or something, okay. Something like that.
So you were in Southeast Asia during SARS. What do you remember of that?
Not a lot, to be honest. At the time, my wife was a journalist, so I should have been better acquainted. But I don't. I mean, the tsunami is really the big sort of disaster that will stay with me.
Yeah.
I don't really remember much about SARS.
Where were you during the tsunami?
Sri Lanka.
Right. In near Gaul or that area?
We were actually in Colombo when the wave hit.
Yeah.
And then Sam was sent down to Gaul. We were on holiday, but she was sent down to cover it. And so I went along. And so I think she was one of the first foreign journalists to be reporting from Gaul. We got there the evening of the day that the wave hit.
Right.
It was, unforgettable. And then we spent a period of time going all the way down the Sri Lankan coast, covering all the tragedy.
Right.
Yeah,
those were grim, grim times.
It was very grim, yeah.
So going back to travel and publishing, you mentioned that you published some guidebooks in the late 1990s, and then you moved onto the Travelfish online business, which I think you founded in 2004.
Yeah, that's correct.
So 2004 was a completely different era for both travel and the region of Southeast Asia. So what were your original aspirations for the business, and how have those sort of objectives changed ever since? It's a long period of time.
Well, we sort of, Sam and I, at the time when we were starting, we were really reformed backpackers.
Yeah.
And originally, we had, neither of us are from a business background. So it was, the site initially was just a collection of our like favorite places in Thailand, which is where we were living at the time. Mm-hmm. And looking back on it, it was really your classic banana pancake kind of stuff. But then after a year or so, I had a unusual job at one of the newspapers there, and Sam was working in, for Agence France-Presse, the French news agency. And so she was largely supporting me while I sort of built the site out. But it was a few years before we started earning any money out of it because mm-hmm. we had no idea what we were doing. Mm-hmm. And then we realized that perhaps it could be something more than a hobby, you know. Mm-hmm. And so as the business grew and we took on more writers and covered more real estate and we had some very good years, and then some not so good years. It's really been quite a roller coaster. And in like when we first started, there was still everybody had a real paper guidebook, you know, like you were either a Lonely Planet or a Rough Guide person kind of thing. But in those intervening years, like TripAdvisor took off and there was a lot more online material that came on, and travel really changed as well with the low-cost airlines coming on board, particularly AirAsia, which changed how people traveled, you know. I mean, when we first started this, the idea of, I don't know, being in Kuala Lumpur and going to Siem Reap for a weekend was like, forget it. Nobody did that. Where now most people, that's probably what they do. And so when you're going somewhere just for a short holiday, like a couple of days, you need a very different sort of portfolio of information. Compared to what we created, which was more along the lines of a traditional guidebook, you know, focusing on longer travel and that kind of thing. So, yeah, it has changed quite a bit. We've sort of been able to roll with some of the changes and not so much with some of the others. But,
So Travelfish is always focused on producing independently researched information, often in off-track destinations for independent travellers. So that must be quite travelling in itself as the region has changed and as people consume content and use travel content in different ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we covered the more obscure places because very much like I think the website is a reflection of how I like to travel, you know, and the kind of places that I like to go to. So a lot of the off-the-beat stuff that we covered, nobody else or few people were really writing about it in any depth, but very few people were going there either, and that's still the case. And so it was very difficult to make money out of, you know, some back town in the middle of nowhere. So we had to cover the more mainstream stuff as well to sort of cross-subsidize the fun work.
So how much time do you personally spend on the road? And do you combine traveling for the business with traveling with the family?
Well, at the moment, none.
Yeah.
Last year, I was away on average about 2 weeks a month.
Okay.
I went through KLIA 2 37 times last year, which I don't recommend. I could quite happily never go to that airport again.
It's a better statistic than the experience.
Yeah, exactly. So normally that would be my kind of travel load, at least 1 to 2 weeks a month.
Yeah.
Obviously now that I'm not traveling at all.
And
I prefer not to travel. I prefer to travel alone. So, I mean, the family and I will take a holiday like once a year or maybe twice a year. But the normal, like where I'm just out doing work, it's much better if I do that by myself.
Sure. I've noticed from looking through the site that you cover 8 of the countries of Southeast Asia, but you don't cover the Philippines or Brunei. Is there a particular reason for that?
I've never been to either of them.
Right.
That's the primary reason. I mean, also now we don't have the resources to cover it even if we wanted to.
Sure.
The site really grew organically. Originally it was Thailand, then it was Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, then we added Vietnam, then we added Malaysia and Singapore, then we added Indonesia, and then we added Burma. So it's been like a step-by-step kind of thing. And then when the business started to suffer a couple of years ago, we ended up with a lot of real estate and not the same number of boots on the ground to cover it, you know.
Yeah, sure. So one of the things I've noticed about your social media pages in your interviews, Stuart, is that you don't pull any punches, which is pretty rare in this sort of PR-gated industry, in this sort of glossed-over travel sector that we work in. Is that sort of upfront honesty, is it proven beneficial or is it a hindrance in any way?
I don't know. I've not really thought about it. I mean, I do speak my mind. And I think that travel media has often been hobbled by the PR kind of angle that a lot of it gets. And I like to push against that.
Sure.
And I mean, the whole like thing with freebies and press junkets and all that kind of stuff. I mean, we've never done any of that because I so strongly disagree with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you can't, if you're not going to walk the walk yourself, you know, you can't sort of complain about other people doing it. So I don't know that it's been a hindrance. I mean, I do the occasional interview and that kind of thing, but we don't sort of chase media coverage
Sure. So let's talk about Travelfish. Who are your readers? Who are your subscribers? And how has that readership changed over the years?
If you had asked me 3 or 4 years ago, I would have said that, I mean, our pool of readership has always been the traditional Western traveling countries. So Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Germany, England would be like the top 5.
Yeah.
But I would have guessed a few years ago, I would have said that an average travel fishery that had been to Southeast Asia previously, mm-hmm. and they would have been 35 to 45 years old. Mm-hmm. But what it's turned out to be the case is the readership is far older than what we expected. And a couple of years ago, somebody on Twitter suggested to me that in the sign-up process, we email people and say, why did you join? You know, to sort of get a bit of a handle on the background of the people, because we weren't really keeping an eye on any of that.
Yeah.
And so we set that up, and then people started emailing me, and they were, you know, the emails would be like, oh, when I was in Bali in 1972, you know, and this kind of thing. And because people would often tell me like their whole travel portfolio.
Right.
And so like the average reader, I would put somewhere around 65.
Right.
You know, who's a lot older than what I would have expected.
So that's back to the hippie trail days.
Well, yeah, I think it's, I think that there is that subset of people who prefer the guidebook style of coverage, which is closer to what we do.
Yeah.
They're not into Instagram or whatever social media that's pushing out travel stuff. They don't want bite-sized photos and top 10 lists and all that kind of stuff. They want more of a authoritative guidebook style product. So I think that's probably part of it. And we've been around, 16 years now.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, that some of them started off in their late 40s. So that we're sort of growing up with them.
Yeah. One of the reasons I wanted to ask you about your readers is that you've just published quite recently the results of your latest reader survey. So I wonder what of those responses stood out for you? Were there any surprises? Were there any things that sort of reinforced what you believed anyway?
It was an interesting process. We had 749 responses to it, which I was really blown away by.
Yeah.
And not surprisingly, you ask two different people the same question, you get two different answers, you know, so some people wanted more text, some people wanted less text, some people wanted more photos, others wanted less photos, you know, like that kind of thing. You can't be everything to everybody.
Yeah.
But like we got some readers were, we suspended our coverage of updating our Burma coverage in response to the genocide there.
Yeah.
And at the time that, I know that put some readers' nose out of joint,
mm-hmm.
and that certainly came through on the survey. Mm-hmm. And people not unfairly sort of saying, well, if you're going to cover Cambodia or Laos,
mm-hmm.
equally have serious human rights issues, why get up on the soapbox about Burma, you know? So I think that's something that I probably could have better communicated at the time when we made the decision.
Yep.
But you know, live and learn. Yeah. I mean, otherwise, it's not any great surprises. I guess there was one of the things people get for membership is they get all these PDF travel guides.
Yeah.
We've got like 300 of them or something, and we had always thought of that as a big selling point for the membership. But a lot of people saw them as completely not useful, you know. So I think that's something we need to take a look at and sort of think about how can we make this something that people are more likely to use.
Yeah, so that brings us on to my next question. It's impossible, Stuart, at the moment to talk travel without talking about the dreaded C word, the coronavirus, which as we know is decimating travel, not just here in Southeast Asia, but around the world. The whole infrastructure of travel is basically just shut down. So as one of your new services during this crisis, you set up Couchfish. Can you explain what that concept is and how that actually differs to what you normally offer your readers?
Okay, well, Couchfish was born out of my frustration, really, because, I mean, living in Indonesia, we're not, disasters aren't uncommon.
Sure.
You know, so if a volcano explodes or there's a tsunami or an earthquake or whatever, I can go out and do something. You know, I can drive supplies or raise money to send aid and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But with this, like all of the advice is stay at home,
yeah.
You know. And, I mean, yeah, it'll drive you mad sitting at home, but, I mean, that's what you've got to do. And so there are all these, and I knew that there were all these people who were keen travelers to, like, we were seeing the cancellations coming through Agoda and Booking, and it was just a bloodbath, you know.
Right, right.
And Travelfish was dead in the water, like, traffic collapsed about, I think we're about 85% down now, and so revenue is zero.
When did that start to collapse, Joe? Was that right from the beginning?
I don't have the analytics open, but it would have, where are we now? April, late Feb.
Right.
Late Feb was when it started to taper.
Yeah, once the lockdown started to kick in.
Yeah, and then by mid-March, it was just forget it,
yeah.
You know. Yeah. So I wanted to come up with, I figured that there had to be like a bunch of people who were stuck on the couch at home and wanted to travel but couldn't. And so we've got all this useful information on the website, but it's not really aspirational stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to come up with some kind of positive product that would, I don't know, just make people a little bit happy, because, I mean, the news cycle is like Jesus, you know. So we came up with this idea of a fantasy trip where we worked on the assumption that all the borders were open, mm-hmm. the buses are running, the hotels are open. So it's just like nothing's changed.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's a daily email, well, Monday to Friday,
mm-hmm.
and it's just following this fantasy trip that I'm doing. Like, I've been to all these places, so it's, you know, I can just sort of pull it out of my head.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like linking out to other interesting content and videos and stuff like that.
Sure.
So when I launched it, I'd spoken to Sam about it, and she was pretty iffy. But then I talked to another friend, and she was like, that's an awesome idea. You've got to do it. And I wasn't sure if there'd be like a lot of pushback about, oh, what are you doing trying to make money out of this crisis and blah, 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 blah. So I put it out, and my email just exploded.
Wow.
You know, at least exploded by my standards.
That was when? When did you actually launch it, Stuart?
Last Tuesday.
Okay.
It's just the response has been just fantastic, you know, and people emailing in saying, I am literally stuck on my couch.
Right, right, right.
And I look forward to nothing more than this email each day.
Yeah.
And the emails aren't like logistical, the bus is like 12 baht or whatever. It's much more like experiential,
yeah.
You know. And people have responded like amazingly to it, and the subscriptions have been very encouraging. And so what we did was we said, if you're an existing Travelfish member, then it's free. You just have to email me and I'll add you to the list. And otherwise, it's at the moment, it's $5 a month or $50 a year. And then once I hit a certain number of subscribers, we're going to start edging the price up. But yeah, so far it's been fantastic. It's a bit of a struggle for me getting into this daily writing kind of thing, but I'm getting there.
It's a nice improvisation under the situation that we're in. Do you think it will endure, hopefully, when there is a containment, when we can all travel again?
Well, I don't know if I want to be writing this for the next 15 years. but I think like one of the things about it, and this sort of ties back to what you were saying earlier about the travel media, is our focus has always been on family-run, locally owned, sustainable businesses,
yeah.
You know, and it's often these small places, they get no, you don't read about them in freaking Travel and Leisure or anything like that. And you're seeing that play out again now, like all the media coverage about the devastation of the travel industry. We're talking about Hyatts and Marriotts and whatever.
Yeah.
But the mum and pup businesses that are getting completely hammered.
Yeah.
You don't read about those.
Yeah.
So again, this was like a way of sort of saying, these are some really great businesses, you know, these are places I have stayed in. So it's just keep giving people at home, allowing them to still be vested in the region in some way. And like in the normal newsletter, we encourage people to reach out to guides they've liked and hostels that they've stayed at and stuff like that and say, look, how can I help?
Yep.
Can I send you a box of masks or 20 bucks or whatever?
Yep.
But it really has to be the traveler initiating this kind of thing. You know, the locals won't do it. They won't ask. So you really need to get in touch and offer. And so we're hoping that as Couchfish builds into something larger, then I'll be able to use it as a better vehicle for that kind of thing.
Sure. Well, that leads neatly into my next question, because it's very interesting for us to be speaking today, because it's actually 80 days since the World Health Organization began publishing its daily coronavirus situation updates. So it's kind of gone around the world in 80 days. We've gone from over tourism to basically zero tourism.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, I phrased this question in terms of, are you hopeful about or pessimistic about travel in Southeast Asia in the post-pandemic period? But I want to phrase that in two ways. What was your feelings before the pandemic struck about the future of travel in the region? And how has this crisis changed or not changed those opinions?
Okay, so before the virus was here, I was fairly pessimistic, I guess, about where travel was going here, I was finding that more and more, like, I hate to be that guy who's saying you should have been here yesterday, you know, but more and more I was seeing I was going to destinations and thinking, good God, I never want to come back here again.
Yeah.
Where in like 98 or 2002 or whatever, it was the best thing since sliced bread.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of like...
Because of the overdevelopment?
Overdevelopment, yeah. I mean, I think the low-cost airlines have a lot of responsibility here. But yeah, like just way too many people going into too restricted a number of destinations. And like I was saying earlier, the short trips. So nobody's actually, when you're only going to Cambodia for 3 days, you don't have time to go to anything else.
Sure.
You know, so it was really like places like Siem Reap, Hoi An, Da Nang, Phuket, Phi Phi. These kind of like, they've just become like ulcers. And so, yeah, I wasn't really feeling too great about it, to be honest. And it became more and more a thing for us where we were saying, stay another day, like trying to get people to slow down. And then this happened, you know? So it's sort of from the sublime to the ridiculous.
And what, I mean, the point that you made earlier is very, very relevant. You know, this is damaging the whole infrastructure of travel. It's hitting every single airline on the planet, every single hotel company. But down at the independent traveler level, it's hurting the small restaurants, the small tour operators, the small activity providers, you know, in small communities. And that's, like you said, often going off the radar a little bit. But, you know, will these people be able to survive?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I had a rant about this the other day on Twitter. I read some story about how Marriott was suffering or something. And it's like, give me a break, you know. I mean, you go to these small businesses and it's like, well, I've had to close and we don't have any money. So the kids are out of school and dad's gone back to do some kind of dangerous work somewhere that he didn't used to have to do. I mean, the example I give is there's a place that we really like on the east coast of Lombok. And after the Bali bombings, they closed because tourism, they say like Bali sneezes and Lombok catches pneumonia.
Sure,
you know?
Sure.
And so it took Lombok a lot longer to come back from the problems from the Bali bombings. So these guys had shut down and they were closed for 11 years. And during that period, the owner became an older guy and he sent his son off to go to university in Mataram in Lombok, where and he was the first kid in the village to get a degree in some kind of tourism services. And so he'd come back and things were picking up and he said, look, Dad, let's reopen the place. And they listed it on booking.com and whatever. And so it was thriving. But that took them 11 years.
Right.
You know? And so I think when people talk about, oh, yeah, well, in 6 months we'll be back to business as usual, it's like, no way, you know. I mean, once places close, like in the case of Bali, by Indonesian standards, Bali is quite an expensive place to live if you're Indonesian. So if you lose your job at some cookie cutter hotel, you're not going to stay here. You're going to go home. When that business decides to reopen, if it ever does reopen, they're going to have to, well, obviously hose the place out, but they're going to have to hire staff and all of this kind of thing. People are going to have to move back. I mean, that kind of restarting infrastructure just doesn't happen overnight.
That's a really good point. And Bali is a microcosm, obviously, of what's happening around the world. I was talking yesterday to a bar owner in KL, and he was just saying exactly the same, that they had to terminate contracts because they're not earning any money. They don't know when they'll be able to reopen. And they didn't want to terminate the contracts of some of their staff, but their staff wanted to go back to their hometowns. And the only way they could actually get out of KL to avoid the movement control order was to have a letter saying that your contract of employment has been terminated.
Exactly. And if this goes on, like, I think that we're looking at least 2 to 2.5 years from today before any kind of substantial recreational tourism restarts, right?
Yeah.
So if that plays out, like, I hope I'm wrong. But if that plays out, that's going to be a substantial number of people working in the service industry that have gone home. So it's not like they're going to be twiddling their thumbs back in the village. They'll be doing something else. They might even not want to come back to Bali afterwards.
Sure. Because it's not like a financial crisis where there is a bottoming out, you know, where economies hit the bottom and then they can start cleaning things up again. It's very likely that countries around the world will recover from this at very, very differentiated rates anyway.
Absolutely. And I think until there is some either a vaccine or some kind of treatment of this, so that you're, as with yellow fever, so that you're able to prove that you're not a risk to the people of wherever you're going, you're not going to be allowed on an aeroplane. You know, so until we get to that point, travel's just, at least responsible travel, is not going to be happening.
I think the vaccine is the ideal opportunity, but it's going to be costly. It's going to take a long time. And it's not going to be available to everybody. I mean, I quite like the idea that China is instituting now of this healthcare app where everybody has to carry it. It does monitor your temperature all the time. I know that's a monitoring, that's a tracking issue. But as we're moving out of this, if travel is ever going to become part of our lives again, there has to be a way that we can actually record and in real time understand whether people are sick or not.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, very early on in this, I was still like, this is like early February. I was of the mindset, I was still telling people, look, if you're young and fit, healthy, you can still travel. It's no problem. Just, you know, don't go to a concert, don't snog a stranger, you know, like that kind of thing. And then it was made very clear to me that how I was looking at things was incorrect. And I've come around to the way of looking at it is you have to assume that you already have it.
Sure.
And so how do you behave to make sure you don't spread it?
Yep.
So, I mean, that is the mindset that really needs to inform all travel, you know, like if you're a risk, like when I sent that newsletter the other day, we had this whole bunch of anti-vaxxers on the travel fish list, which I didn't realize. And so they all emailed me and saying, you know, it's a global conspiracy and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And one guy said, well, if you're going to force me to have a vaccination, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to travel. And it's like, okay, that's fine, dude. Stay at home. Because if you're willing to travel without knowing whether you're going to be making the people where you're going ill or not, then that's the epitome of irresponsible travel. So it's going to take a while for that stuff to sink in, I think.
That's a very valid point. I mean, we are in a period of, obviously, the word that keeps getting used is unprecedented, but when everybody is trying to forecast when these things get better, when travel is going to become back up and running to some degree of normality, you know, we're talking a longer term period, but we're also talking in the shorter term. People's way of living has changed entirely. We wash our hands much more than we ever do. We're much more attuned to our own health and our own vulnerability, I guess. For those first few weeks out of our lockdowns, you know, I think people will behave differently.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it is like, as you said, unprecedented. And I think people are still figuring it out. Like, obviously, like the Indonesian government is still trying to figure it out. But I mean, it's a very steep learning curve, and it's unfortunate that so many people are getting sick and dying while we try and figure out what to do about it.
Stuart, it's been great to talk to you. I just want to wrap this up with one final question. This is obviously a tricky and very inappropriate time to talk about trip planning. But before the pandemic was struck, where was next on your radar? Where were you supposed to be going next? And if things do hopefully get a little bit better, will you continue with that same schedule, or are there other places that you really want to go to in the near future?
Well, I turned 50 this July, and we had planned to go to Alor, which is an island that I love in Far Eastern Indonesia. And so we'd already booked it. And it's this tiny island that you can walk around in like an hour, and it has one little place to stay on it. We rent a wooden house there. And I look across the ocean, and there's a volcano right there, and it's the best thing ever. So if there was to be some kind of miracle where we were able to travel in July, that's where I would be going. But I think that's going to be highly unlikely. It's more likely people, you know, walk across the rice fields to the mini mart or something like that. That's adventure travel now, you know.
On that note, Stuart, thank you very, very much for your time. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. There's some great insights there. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Yeah. I don't know if you saw the news, but this morning, Lonely Planet have just announced that they're closing their Melbourne and London offices entirely, effective immediately.
I didn't see that, but I'm not surprised. Who owns Lonely Planet now? I mean, it was BBC for a while, but it's not, is it?
It's now a cigarette magnate in Tennessee or something.
Wow.
I think 9/11 almost killed them.
Right.
But I think this will drive a stake through the heart. You know, I think it's, which is a sad day. You know, I think they're the last real publisher doing it. Yeah. Semi-